Welcome to the Object-Oriented UX Podcast, a podcast about tackling complexity head-on, gracefully organizing massive amounts of information, and designing scalable, future-proof, and of course, naturally intuitive object-oriented user experiences. An OUXer is a powerful blend of information architect, business analyst, facilitator, and UX strategist. If this sounds like you or what you aspire to, you are so in the right place. I'm Sophia Prater, UX designer, chief evangelist of Object-Oriented UX, and your host. Let's jump into it.
What's up, OUXers? Oh my goodness, it is podcast day again. Y'all, I've been so preoccupied with getting cohort 5 up and running that I've completely neglected to set up interviews again. I cannot believe it's been 2 weeks since I recorded the last solo episode. So I've got about 10 invites that I need to send out for podcast interviews, but I haven't done that yet. But I promise next time it's not going to be just me, but we're doing another solo episode. On that note also, if you know somebody that you think that I should interview, please reach out to me on Twitter at SophiaVUX, or if you think I should interview you. Are you using Object-Oriented UX at work? Have you found success with it? Have you found challenges with it? Contact me on Twitter at SophiaVUX or write us at hello@rewiredux. If you have a recommendation of somebody that should be on the podcast or you think that you should be on the podcast, that would be awesome. So I definitely have a lot of people that I want to interview. I just haven't contacted them yet. So here we are again, just the two of us. But this is going to be interesting. I have something really important to talk about today that kind of came out of nowhere. So earlier today, this did not come out of nowhere. Sophia, what are you talking about? It just kind of popped up again. This is something that's been popping up for the last few months. So earlier today in the self-paced masterclass Slack channel that we've got, so we have a Slack channel just for the folks that are going through the self-paced OUX masterclass. So I got a great question from Erica Queen. Thank you, Erica, who's working through the OUX masterclass. And she asked a question that, as I said, I've heard this before, actually more of a criticism of OUX that perhaps you've heard from your colleagues or even thought yourself. So for those that are skeptical that OUX is just a fancy new word for information architecture, I'm taking that on today. I really hope I don't start a war, but I'm taking that on. So here's what Erica wrote me. Thank you so much for sharing OUX with us. It's been incredibly helpful for me and continues to stretch my brain as I work with it. I've been working on a very complex project with a client, and your approach has helped me better think through and communicate the complexity of the system to both other designers and to senior leadership I work with. All right, awesome. Why I'm writing. I know you're looking for questions today, and mine doesn't have so much to do with practicing OUX, but rather with a criticism of OUX I've heard from another very senior UX practitioner in the community. They've called OUX, quote, an IA rebrand we didn't need. I didn't see anything in OUX that someone well-versed in IA wouldn't have done or considered. I've read several of your articles, and that's totally fair. I've read several of your articles that define OUX as a set of principles and a philosophy, and ORCA is the methodology used to conduct OUX. Do you have any materials, or would you be willing to speak about the differences and similarities between OUX and IA? Do you see OUX as its own thing or as an extension of IA? It'd be really enlightening to understand where OUX fits into the landscape. So thank you, Erica, and also thank you to whoever is thinking that perhaps this is an IA rebrand. This is for you. Probably we'd be really good friends if we got on the same page. So probably this is coming from just not digging into OUX quite far enough. Okay, so I also want to not just thank Erica, I also want to thank Upma Singh, who has also relayed this question to me from something she saw in Reddit. Upma is a certified OUX strategist, and she came to me saying, I don't really know how to answer this question either. So it's really great to hear this pushback so that I can address it. If you're thinking this, if you've heard this, you're not alone. Okay, so first, let's start with some definitions. I'm going to talk about the definition of OUX and the definition of information architecture, or some definitions of information architecture. And then what I'm going to get into is some cognitive science, just kind of the differences and how IA and UX treats cognitive science and perception, documentation, the actual artifacts that come out of the process itself, and also what IA does that object-oriented UX does not do. There's a lot of that. There's a lot that information architecture tackles that OUX kind of skates over at a high level and kind of puts a pin in and it's like, this is a job for an information architect. So I will get into that as well. All right, so the definition of object-oriented UX, if you've been in any of my presentations, you've heard this. Object-oriented UX is a philosophy for designing digital systems that respects the fact that people think in objects and need consistent, recognizable objects to understand an environment or product. OUXers deliberately align their software to the user's real-world mental model of concrete, defined objects so that abstract digital worlds can be as naturally intuitive as the physical world we evolved in. Okay, so for the IA definitions, I've got my trusty polar bear book here, which I'm going to recommend like 16 times in this podcast episode at least. Everybody should read it. I've read it 3 times. It has been influential. But there's things that are not in the information architecture polar bear book. This is the latest edition that Jorge Arango came onto. Also a big fan of Jorge Arango. He's been on the podcast. I've been on his podcast. I've read his books. Okay, anyway, definitions. All right. So the authors give actually 4 definitions, and I'm going to read them all. 1, the structural design of shared information environments. 2, the synthesis of organization, labeling, search, and navigation systems within digital, physical, and cross-channel ecosystems. 3, the art and science of shaping information products and experiences to support usability, findability, and understandability. 4, an emerging discipline and community of practice focused on bringing principles of design and architecture to the digital landscape. So that last one's pretty broad. But you can see, probably already off the bat, you can see some similarities and definitely some differences. Object-oriented UX is, for one, very object-oriented. It's all about the objects, while objects are not actually mentioned at all in any of those definitions. So, big surprise, object-oriented UX. Object definition is a central part of it, where it seems to be an afterthought a lot of the time in information architecture. There's actually nothing, I'm not going to say nothing, but it's usually not so much of a central part. Okay, so those are definitions. When Erica first wrote me and when I hear this question, the first thing that comes to mind is not just the object centrality of object-oriented UX, but sort of how the psychology and cognitive science of perception is so central to object-oriented UX. So Jorge Arango and Andrew Hinton, whom I am both great fans of, they do get into this when it comes to perception and how information environments are perceived, how kind of the mind takes in information environments. Andrew Hinton gets a lot into embodied cognition, which I've also had him on the podcast, and we've talked about this together before quite a lot, actually, over the years. I highly recommend their books. I highly recommend their information. I think it's a big foundation of the thinking that I sort of have layered on in object-oriented UX. Because nowhere specifically in my information architecture reading and learning and studying have I ever heard anyone talk about how people think and understand by understanding objects. And the second part to that is understanding how that understanding of objects manifests into design. What does that actually mean for design? So when the rubber hits the road, as far as I know, I'm the only one really talking about shapeshifters, masked objects, and broken objects by any label. So, I mean, I've definitely been looking for that, for sure. Has anybody else talked about this? So shapeshifters being an object, the same object looking different in different contexts for no good reason, totally arbitrary changes. The example that I give a lot is in meetups. So we've got an event card on the homepage versus an event card in a group page. all the metadata is moved around. The visual design has changed. So there's, it kind of ties into the design system and keeping a consistent design system, but specifically around not just making sure all of our dropdowns look the same and all of our buttons look the same, but that all of our objects look the same, unless we have a really good reason to be shifting things around. Because of cognitive science, because if an object is changing a lot, it's going to add cognitive load. It's going to be harder to recognize that thing. And then on the flip side with those masked objects, I believe I'm the only one talking about that, how in a design system, we don't want to have these generic cards where we say, okay, this is our homepage card, or this is our search results card, and anything can fit in it. So we end up with a lot of objects looking the same and wearing the same outfit. So we get a hybrid of that in a lot of our experiences where we have shapeshifters and masked objects sort of working together to add a whole lot of cognitive load to the user, because we haven't really defined our objects and respected the fact that because people think in objects, we want to make sure that they're as consistent as possible and distinctive as possible. That an event and a venue aren't wearing the same outfit. They look like two different things, and I can actually start seeing the relationship between an event and a venue. And then also broken objects, making sure that our calls to action are as closely knit to the objects. It's really clear what you're doing things to. So, you know, we've definitely talked about affordances and direct manipulation. That conversation is happening. I think that I'm bringing a little something new to that. Object-oriented UX is bringing a little something new to that. But definitely it is building upon the ideas of affordances and direct manipulation. But really making sure, like, what does that actually mean when it comes to freaking button placement? We're really kind of getting down to that nitty-gritty detail. So one thing with I didn't mention isolated objects. So isolated objects are being covered in the information architecture world. So those are kind of the four horsemen that I talk a lot about, the broken objects, shapeshifters, masked objects, and isolated objects. Those first three I don't think are being covered, at least not with the rigor that we're covering within the OAUX community. I will give isolated objects for sure, not by that particular name. That's sort of an OUX term, for lack of a better term that I've heard. But I've heard dead ends before. But definitely Mike Atherton and Carrie Hain deserve a lot of credit for this, as well as Sarah Watcher-Boetcher, also from Content Everywhere. And sorry, let me get this right. Okay. Mike Atherton and Carrie Hain from their book, Designing Connected Content, and Sarah Watcher-Boetcher, I think I got that right, haven't practiced that in a few years. Sarah, haven't said your name out loud in a few years. Definitely have been reading it and seeing it. Her book from way ahead of its time, back from 2013, Content Everywhere. So a lot of folks have been talking about, especially in the content world and the content strategy world, about connecting content and making sure that we're building roads between our content and building navigation between our content through connections. So I do think in OAUX we kind of like take it a step further, but I'm building upon a lot of those ideas. Okay, so to sort of recap, I know it's kind of all over the place there. We have some laws of OAUX, and those laws of OAUX, I'll kind of go through them. They align to those four horsemen, and they actually align to the ORCA process: objects, relationships, CTAs, and attributes. So our law of objects, which helps us get rid of those masked objects, is objects that are different should look different. Okay, so we want to, and to do that, we need to identify what our objects are. So there needs to be a part in our process to be really clear on what are the objects so that we can make sure that they look different. When it comes to the R of the ORCA process, relationships, we want to avoid those isolated objects. We want to make sure our objects are connected. One, to help define the objects, because the relationships between the objects helps strengthen the definition of those objects. It puts them in context of each other and also paves the road for navigation. So that law is objects that are connected in the real world, connected by the user's mental model of how those objects are connected. An example I give a lot is classes and students. Students have many classes. A class has many students. Classes have assignments. students have students complete assignments and turn in homework assignments. So all of those connections that are true about the real world, we want to reflect in our digital navigation. Okay, when it comes to the C, calls to action, all right, we want to avoid those broken objects. And the OUX law there is objects should be directly manipulable as much as possible. So we want to honestly use gestalt and make sure it's really clear that this button is acting upon this particular object. There's lots of examples of that not being true. And to basically edit the thing, you have to go up to an upper right-hand corner hamburger menu and pull something down to take action on the thing on the other side of the page. So direct manipulation, that's sort of the other law of, that is the third law of object-oriented UX. And then for attributes, the A of the ORCA process, we have the law that we want to prevent our shapeshifters. And that law is objects that are the same should look the same. So it's sort of the flip side of those masked objects. Okay. So we have those four laws of object-oriented UX. And I don't see those laws being covered in the information architecture literature that I have read so far. And then I'll probably say this multiple times during this podcast, but please correct me if I am wrong. I hope to start a conversation, not a war, on Twitter, but please kindly let me know if there's something else I should be reading. So at Sophia VUX. The one that I will kind of say, yes, information architecture is covering is that R, the relationships. I do see a whole lot of that. Okay, if you want to know more, quick plug, if you do want to know more about those unintuitive objects, check out oaux.com/4mistakes. I have a 2-hour mini workshop on this. It's a live recording. I'm just charging $7 for it, so buy me a beer for that 2-hour workshop. And then it'll go over a whole lot of examples on all four of these. And then actually, there's some worksheets that you can download. And actually kind of be very active during the workshop. So it's good stuff. Okay, so the second thing I want to talk about is documentation. And here's something where I think OUX, or somewhere where I think OUX really shines, is in the visual documentation. There's a lot of really great artifacts that come out of traditional information architecture work. But one thing you don't have is the object map and the CTA matrix. All right, which I just think they're just power tools for visualization and collaboration. So I've seen content models and entity relationship diagrams that do illustrate objects, often called content types, objects/content types, and actually list out attributes as well, and even their operations, kind of the CTAs for each of those objects, and of course the relationships, showing those relationships sometimes with some fancy crow's feet diagramming. So I have seen that come out of the information architecture and content strategy community, and definitely the dev community as well, with entity relationship diagrams and UML and all that good stuff. The thing is, from a documentation perspective and a visualization perspective and a collaboration perspective, the object map and the CTA matrix are just bang-up tools. And I do think that they are a better way of visualizing than the ERD or a content model, or really any visual artifact that I've seen come out of information architecture for those specific things, for modeling objects, their attributes, and their relationships, and CTAs that are attached to them based on role. That's the reason that I've kind of invented the object map and the CTA matrix, because I didn't have a tool. And after doing a lot of information architecture study, I still didn't see that tool that was doing what I needed it to do. So object maps are basically, they're really scalable. They're scalable to as many relationships and objects and attributes as you need. And the CTA matrix, it incorporates roles elegantly right off the bat. So you kind of start getting into permissions pretty early in the process. It's not an afterthought. And usually when we think about operations, if I see operations attached inside an ERD or a content model, usually roles, there's not a really good way to visually show roles. And also when those types of diagrams scale, so a content model or an ERD scales, you kind of start to get a messy bowl of spaghetti. And like, what do you do if you have an object that has 160 attributes? And like, and 12 different relationships, and maybe the relationship between, let's say it's a medical record software. So you have like the patient and a diagnosis, and there might be multiple different relationships. There might be a history of diagnoses. There might be potential diagnoses. There might be current diagnoses. There might be debated diagnoses based on different doctors. So there's a connection to doctors, and it just turns into kind of a mess of a diagram. It becomes really difficult to read, and it becomes sort of difficult to edit too. And if it becomes difficult to edit, it kind of becomes difficult to collaborate on. And, you know, just have a bunch of people moving an entity relationship diagram around doesn't work very well. So the object map kind of, I think, wins on that in that department. So the object map, you know, just the nature of it, and we've worked, I mean, years and years in developing this particular documentation. You can have an object with 200 attributes. You can have an object even with 2,000 attributes if you need. And then you can document all those different relationships through how we show nested objects. Really as much as you want. And if you have a system with 19, 20 objects, that's kind of okay. The documentation scales. The other thing is you can go, because when you have each attribute sort of on its own card. So if we move from something like Mural or physical sticky notes into something like Trello or Airtable or Notion, we can basically create a whole world for each attribute where we start getting into some really detailed UX and information architecture requirements, like, is this attribute required? Or let's go ahead and document where this attribute is coming from. Is it user generated? Is it required? Does it come from an API? If so, what API does it come from? You know, we can get into that level of detail. We can actually go in to a Trello card just around, let's say, you know, current diagnoses, which is a nested object within the patient. And we can go in and we can have a conversation around that. We can go into the comments and have a conversation around that. So just as far as like collaboration documentation, I mean, the object map is a real winner. And I think every information architect would love to use an object map. It's just a really great tool. In OAUX, we also, within the object map, I mean, just from a documentation's perspective, we differentiate between core content and metadata. And sometimes in information architecture, I just kind of hear metadata and attributes used interchangeably. I like to differentiate between, we could put them on core content on yellow sticky notes and metadata on pink sticky notes. We were actually color coding them and determining the difference between attributes that make each instance of an object unique, like title and even like ID, social security number, email address, things that like every instance probably was going to have a unique value, versus metadata that we're going to have some sort of taxonomy around it. We're going to have some sort of structure around it. And that's going to be the attributes that a user is most likely going to sort and filter a list of those objects. So this helps us visualize and see, oh, this object over here, we're going to have about 6,000 instances of this object in the system, but we only have identified 3 pieces of metadata. Like, we might need more metadata because people need more power of sorting and filtering. So it helps us sort of visualize that. I don't see a whole lot of that differentiation. And really differentiation also by core content being a content creation problem, while metadata being more of a tagging problem, more of like an information architect's problem or a developer's problem, while core content, I mean, we have, you know, from an information architecture perspective, putting a video saying, oh, this object has a video on it,
simple, right? Even from a UX perspective, video goes here. From a content creation perspective, if we want video on 6,000 instances of an object and we don't have that video yet, we're probably going to need to hire somebody. So we start actually looking at the difference between core content and metadata, which is something I don't see a lot of. And again, please tweet me if you've seen that being documented and you've seen that sort of dichotomy been explored already in the information architecture world. I would love to look at that.
So in the end, information architecture might cover objects and relationships and sort of CTAs and attributes, but they don't have the object map or the CTA matrix, which is basically a matrix. We didn't really get into that too much, but it's objects by role. And what do each of the different roles do to each of the objects? I just haven't seen that type of documentation. So OAUX really gives us a great way to visualize and do detailed yet visual documentation and collaborate all in sort of like a really approachable game-like way with like color-coded sticky notes. Like it's actually fun and feels like solving a puzzle. So I'm actually going to be talking about this more at the UX Hustle Summit. So that is September 24th and 25th. I did a survey on the theme of the conference is future-proofing your career. I highly recommend coming. Jared Spool is keynoting. Charlie Marie is going to be on the Career Path panel. She was our keynote speaker last year. Yeah. Famous YouTuber in our community. Let's see what else. Oh my gosh, other reasons to go to UX Hustle Summit. Joe Natoli is actually moderating the panel, which is really cool too. So it's going to be super fun. And I'm doing a talk specifically on how to run these types of workshops. And I'm doing that because I made this list of top 10 ways OAUX can help you future-proof your career. And I got my community to vote on their top 3 points, and those top 3 points turned into my UX Hustle talk. And the number one by far was how to make information architecture fun, collaborative, and approachable. So that tells me that in general, information architecture can be not very approachable. It kind of can feel a little bit intimidating. So OAUX is just a really great way to help bring people into the information architecture process, which I do think is something good that OAUX can add to the information architecture world. Okay, on that note, the third thing I want to talk to you about is process. So the ORCA process, so again, ORCA is objects, relationships, CTAs, and attributes. And the ORCA process, which is what I teach, is like the methodology around to OAUX. So you have OAUX as the philosophy the overarching philosophy, while ORCA is my particular process to make really great object-oriented user experiences. So ORCA is repeatable. It is a repeatable framework. And information architecture books and courses and articles, again, I'll just caveat the heck out of this, at least in my experience and in my reading, seem to give you a whole lot of tools and theory and best practice and lingo, but not a whole lot of end-to-end process. So I highly recommend reading all those books. Again, like I've said, I've read the Polar Bear book 3 times. I probably do for another reading. And Designing Connected Content by Mike and Carrie is a book I'm constantly referencing and recommending. But when it comes to where do I start, many UX designers don't know where to fit information architecture into their process. Is it just the sitemap and the main navigation? That's it, right? No, we know that that's not it. But that's kind of where a lot of UX designers fit it in. And the IA community, I don't think at the end of the day, has made it incredibly clear and easy to do information architecture in a real meaningful way. So please don't come after me. I know that sounds so incendiary. I'm like blushing right now, just saying, and I'm getting hot here in my little podcast studio. But just don't come after me. Just simply ask a bunch of junior or mid-level designers how information architecture fits into their process. And I can rest my case, most likely. The answer is going to be, I don't know how it fits in. It's the sitemap. General Assembly, last time I checked, had about 1 day of information architecture in their curriculum, and it's here's how you make a sitemap. So, again, correct me if I'm wrong.
please, nicely, correct me nicely. So the ORCA process, object relationships, calls to action, attributes, is literally 15 freaking steps of a playbook that helps designers synthesize research into object-centered information architecture, also a database model that devs can come in and collaborate on. This is just object-oriented by nature. It's basically creating a user-centered database design that you can directly connect to your developers on. It synthesizes that research also into detailed UX and UI requirements and user stories, having those user stories nested under the objects that the user is acting upon. So you can, you know, reduce those broken objects so that you can have nicely, directly manipulable objects. Okay, so it's just a meat grinder of a process. And I just haven't seen a whole lot of step-by-step, this is how you do IA. just a whole lot of here's some best practices. Here's how you do controlled vocabularies. Here's how you do information architecture research. But how you kind of pull it together step-by-step. If you know of something like that, a solid, iterative as well, step-by-step information architecture process, I would love to see that. Going back to those detailed UX and UI requirements that the ORCA process helps kind of steps you through and sort of kind of reminds, there's a lot of checklists and stuff like that and at the different steps. Let me just give an example of the level of detail that the ORCA process walks you through. So there's literally a place in the process where we think about, if we have a list of objects under another object, which is what we call a nested object. So for example, I'm looking at a project object and I see all the people on that project. Okay, we have a list of people nested under a project. What will be the default sort on those people in context of a project? So is it the most recently added person shows up on the top? Or is it the most active person on the project that shows up on the top? And are there other ways to sort or even filter? Okay. And we'll be looking at cardinality. So a project has zero to many people on it. Okay, how many is many? In general, and we might need to go back to research to figure that out, is it generally 10 people that are going to be on a project within the system? Or might we have 150 people on a project within the system? Because if it's 150 people, all right, we might need to have ways for a user to actually sort and filter that nested list. All right, so maybe by default it shows the most active at the top, but we also want people to be able to filter by role within the context of a project, right? Or filter by activity. So only show me people that have been active today on this project. Now, if there's only 10 people on a project, I probably don't need to do that. I don't need as many sorting and filtering mechanisms for a user. But if the cardinality is, if many means 150 or 1500 or something like that, then I definitely want more to give the user sorting and filtering ability, not just on the list of people within the system, but when I'm looking at a project and I'm seeing people within the project. Right, we talk about that. That is a line item to go over. We also talk about, is that filter sticky or not? So if I'm looking at project X and I filter just to show managers on the project, so just people with role manager, okay, and then I move to project Y, is that filter sticky? Am I still just seeing managers? Or does the filter reset itself? What's going to be best for the user? So we're talking about getting into that level of thinking before wireframing, and it's all part of this streamlined, repeatable process. So when it comes to UX and UI requirements and having a really great way to think through all those potentialities, potentialities is a big word, and how to document that and where to document that and templates for where to document that, show me an information architecture process that gets into that kind of detail. And then the last three steps of the process actually take you through pulling all of that information together from those first three rounds, discovery, requirements, and prioritization. So now that you've prioritized, now it takes you through sketching and prototyping and testing testing that prototype of what you've created, this kind of good foundational system. And now you can test that you've got your objects, your relationships, your calls to action, and your attributes right before going and designing and testing your interaction design. So as far as I can tell, the Polar Bear book, any other information architecture documentation that I've seen doesn't give you that kind of end-to-end process. So please, again, let me know if you've seen this, that really repeatable end-to-end meat grinder of a process that is also, that's not strict, right? It's flexible. It's scalable. It's adaptable. It's iterative. We go through those, the O's, the R's, the C's, and the A's. We go through it four times and within, you know, increasing fidelity. And each step actually builds on the last. I just haven't seen that. So if you've seen it, again, let me know, please. Okay. None of this is saying that OUX is better than information architecture. Please don't think I'm saying that. I do think that the object map is pretty badass and all information architects would just eat it up and love it as far as a documentation tool. But there are also a ton of things that IA gets into that OUX does not get into. For example, let's say we're making a website for the North Georgia Winery Association. So all 20 plus wineries in the North Georgia region want to come together to create a one-stop shop website for people to plan their wine tour and learn about Georgia wine country, which is where I live. Lucky me. The only place within walking distance is a golf course and a winery. Living the good life in our little cabin up here. Just here under the stairs, talking about OUX and information architecture. Okay, so in OUX, we're going to do a bunch of research or bring a bunch of research in, and we're going to do some noun foraging, figure out, well, what are the nouns we're hearing over and over again. So we might come up with some objects like wineries, wines, wine types, grape types, varietals, events even. And we're going to maybe say, okay, there's a connection between wine and wine type. Like you would have Sauvignon Blanc, and you would have Cartier Vineyards Chimney White 2017, which is a Sauvignon Blanc. Or would vintage be another object? Uh-oh, head scratcher. So maybe it's more like Sauvignon Blanc, okay, and then is the type, and then Cartier Vineyards Chimney White is the wine, and then Cartier Vineyards Chimney White 2017 is the vintage of that wine. Okay, so we'll kind of model all of that out. And we might say, okay, wine type should have color metadata. So red, white, or blush, maybe even bubbles. So sparkling or semi-sparkling or still, and the varietal like Cab Sav, et cetera. So we would probably model that kind of thing. We might even define that the values of varietal should be dependent on color. So if I select red, that's going to narrow down the list of varietals. But an information architect would get into way more detail on the taxonomy and synonym rings and that kind of thing. So an information architecture might make sure that the system knows that blush is also pink to improve search results. So if somebody searches pink wine, they're going to get blush wines back, right? And an information architect is going to create or find an existing schema for wine varietals and figure out how to adapt that schema for North Georgia in particular and figure out, okay, if there's any hierarchy within that schema, like do we need to flatten it for North Georgia? How many layers of hierarchy do we actually need for this particular use case? That's going to be way more in an information architecture realm of working. An information architect would be more likely to dissect the relationship between Shiraz versus Syrah, like Pinot Gris versus Pinot Grigio, and they'll make the call. So if someone searches Pinot Gris, are we going to show Pinot Grigios as well? Probably should. And then like getting into tasting notes, like citrus or like the level of acidity or whether something has strawberry undertones or overtones. An OUXer might just have tasting notes on a metadata pink sticky under the wine with like a big star next to it that says we need an information architecture to help us with this because tasting notes, how does that work? Are there synonym rings that we need to be thinking about? Is there like an ontology where we need to kind of come up with like the closer relationships between these things? And what level are users actually looking for when it comes to tasting notes? Okay, and there is so much more that information architects get in that we just don't get into in object-oriented UX. There's definitely overlap, but object-oriented UX doesn't replace information architecture by any stretch of the imagination, but information architecture doesn't tackle everything that object-oriented UX does. And object-oriented UX takes it from a certain perspective, like philosophical perspective of people thinking in objects. So I think every OUXer needs to be reading up on information architecture and studying it hard. I also think most every information architecture would architect the most information architects would really love OUX. Okay, so we've got the cognitive science stuff, the visualization documentation that's different, and this kind of end-to-end meat grinder of a process that Orca gives you. And then we got into some of the details on what OUX doesn't give you that information architecture does. In the end, I have to admit that OUX could be called OOIA. It's almost more information architecture than it is UX. But because we get into that C in the Orca process, really a quarter of the process is all about analyzing the user interactions in context of objects. I just feel like it spills beyond information architecture. And I, as being the chief evangelist of OUX, I grew up as an industrial designer and then a UX designer. So this is sort of the world that I see the lens through. So once again, I hope this starts a healthy conversation or even a debate. If I'm wrong, please tell me nicely on Twitter at SophiaVUX. But let's not go to war. We're all on the same team here trying to make digital environments more intuitive and more humane. And I like to think of myself as part of the information architecture community, hopefully not a thorn in its side trying to reinvent the wheel. That is not what I'm after. And I also like to think of all information architects as welcome additions to the OUX community. So let's keep the conversation going. Cheers. Happy OUXing, IAing, and everything in between.
Thank you so much for listening. I truly hope you enjoyed this episode. Please visit objectorientux.com/podcast for show notes. Our soundtrack is Fighter by Ruby Vell, courtesy of Sugaroo Records. Happy OUXing!